This last segment here, one of our favorite guys to have on to talk politics with, exchange political analyses with, and yes, most importantly, spar with our friend Colin Delaney of ePolitics.com. Colin, how are you tonight, my man?
I'm doing great. How are you guys tonight?
Pretty good. This is going to be a roundtable, actually, here, Colin. One of our fellow FDH Lounge dignitaries, my man Nate Noy, of extraordinarily similar political persuasions to myself, is on. So sort of a bizarro world equivalent of last time with you and Carl v. me.
It's okay, man. You know, I've been studying my debate tactics. I've been studying with Mel Gibson, so I think I'm ready.
Ooh,
I'm prepared.
Very good. We're starting this one off strong. I guess you mentioned it to me as soon as we started communicating for this week's show. You were at Netroots Nation over the weekend here. Where was that? Was that in Vegas?
It was in Vegas. That was my first time in Vegas.
First time? No, Vegas is my favorite place to go to. Where was the conference at, actually?
It was at the Rio.
Well, you know, let's start on a non-political note. What did you think of Vegas for your first time out there?
You know what? After about 2 days, I'd had enough. I don't gamble. So, and after a while, I got really tired of the slot machine screaming at me everywhere.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, but it's just not my kind of town. You know, I'm glad I got to see it. The conference was great. The conference was fantastic time.
It's funny. How's this for being a masochist, man? Our FDH New York Bureau, who, of course, is the guy who booked you for us for the first time on the show way back when, last time he was out in Vegas, he went to a Vegas 51s game out there. I think it was a daytime baseball game. Can you imagine going? And now he said
that was something. No, I spent a little time. They have a pool there that's sort of a fake beach bar. They even have a little beach. And so I spent a little bit of time in the afternoons out by the pool bar a couple of times. But even with a frozen margarita and in the shade, I couldn't stay there more than about 45 minutes or an hour.
My favorite...
It was hot. It was 110.
My favorite story about the Rio involves my friend Michelle, who went out there to have her wedding there, and she flew her family out there, and she has a very colorful family. And apparently, in the aftermath of the whole wedding proceedings, I guess one of her sisters ended up banging some 3-foot Iranian guy against one of the ice machines. So that's what I always think of when I think of the Rio.
Yeah, I think that's not a bad not a bad example to have in your head. Anyway, why don't we move on? I hate to say anything bad about any random company, city. You know, you don't want to rile up the public unnecessarily.
Well, exactly. Yeah, you know what? How's this for a segue? Probably the kind of debauchery you saw in Netroots Nation, correct?
We had a good time. We definitely had a good time. A lot of good parties. I met a ton of fantastic people. There were about 2,000, 2,500, something like that of us there. And it was a mix. You know, there were some bloggers. There were plenty of nonprofit people. There were union folks. There were just individual political activists. There were certainly people from campaigns. I met several very impressive candidates. I met a woman who's running for lieutenant governor in Texas for the first time. And I'll tell you, she was something else. And I'm definitely keeping an eye on her. Bill White is running for governor, and he has carried Houston against opposition by, like, insane margins. We're talking, like, 88% of the vote or something crazy like that. And he's running pretty even with Rick Perry right now, so we'll see what happens.
That is an interesting story right there, and a very unlikely outcome if it were to come. But this has been a year of unlikelihood, albeit most of the upsets have come on the right side of the spectrum as opposed to the left. What's the general mood of the people out there? Because, I mean, it's very interesting to me because, again, to guys like me and Nate, you know, we're very much aggrieved about a lot of the things that have been happening here. And Obama has racked up a lot of legislative accomplishments, and yet... Based on everything I've seen coming out of there, you got a lot of disgruntled people who think he didn't get enough on all of these accomplishments here. So what were you seeing and picking up when you were out there?
I don't know if disgruntled is the right word. I think there was a lot of unhappiness, absolutely. But mostly folks were just determined. You know, they really don't want to see Democrats get beat for the wrong reasons, right? Most of it, I mean, Democrats can get beat for the right reasons, and, well, that's just politics. But we don't want to see Democrats get beat for the wrong reasons. There was a lot of unhappiness in Andrew Biden's butt. That's something I do want to talk with you guys about. I'm just curious to see how y'all come out of that, you know, considering that he basically lied. You know, he...
Colin, you there, buddy? I think you cut out. Are you there?
Oh, did I? I'm sorry, guys.
No, yeah.
It's my fault. Just want to say, there was a lot of anger at the administration, just flat-out anger at the administration over how they handled that situation.
Okay. Nate, let me ask you. I mean, what's your take on what happened with the Breitbart situation here? Again, I've been a guy who's been a backer of the guy in the past. I mean, I'm sort of inclined to give him the benefit of the doubt that I think he was probably a little sloppy, didn't review it, as opposed to it being a deliberate thing here on his part to distort what the woman said. I vote for sloppiness. What say you, Nate?
Yeah, I'm more with you, Rick. I think it's more of incompetence and sloppiness as opposed to, you know, something devious like some more of the, you know, the top tiers would be guilty of. So I think he, you know, I wouldn't put him in that top tier of intelligence or anywhere near it. So it's probably just incompetence and sloppiness as well.
Go read William Fallison's piece on Slate.com where he goes through the original video minute by minute and shows how even now Breitbart is systematically lying about what is on the unedited version. He's just lying. And, you know, fool me once, shame on me. Fool me twice, or shame on you. Fool me shame on me. Come on, if this is who you guys are going to hold up as a standard bearer, I mean, he's an outright fraud.
Well, I will grant you, I haven't read that column, and I will read it with an open mind, and I think, again, you and I have talked about this in the past, and I know Nate's with me on this, too, because we're guys who are not partisan guys, but ideological guys, and it's a thing where I don't want to see that kind of sloppiness because, as far as I'm concerned, and this is where I differ with you, Colin, there's a whole boatload to legitimately discredit these guys on anyways. I don't think you have to resort to that kind of penny-ante crap, so I'll be very
disappointed.
I agree
with you 100%. I agree with you.
You know,
that's why I say, I think if Democrats lose legitimately, that's life. That's politics.
Well, and let me ask you this. I mean, as far as penny-ante partisan crap here, this might be a rare point of convergence among the three of us. I'll put this to you first, Nate, and you and I have talked about this off air and in a lot of our myriad political conversations, but I'm convinced here, as far as, you know, the nonstop partisanship, talking points, everything like that, whether it be Boehner and McConnell, whether it be Limbaugh, whether it be, now again, I don't necessarily lump all of them into that. I don't necessarily lump Beck into that. I most certainly do with Hannity. I go on a case-by-case basis who I put in that thing. Whatever Obama's at in the polls, I would subtract another couple points were it not for them. I think there are a couple. I think the Republicans are artificially propping up Obama by a couple of points by this kind of stuff, and by the fact that, again, they're not just picking their spots on the guy. They're hitting all the time in a way to where it's the boy who cries wolf. And, you know, people of our political persuasion can't get, you know, people to always listen to the stuff that is maybe the most legitimate. Nate, what do you think?
Oh, absolutely, Rick. And, I mean, political hacks on either side of the spectrum, you know, they get old on the public. The public's tolerance for that is nonsense, and they just lend a deaf ear to it at some point. The GOP has lost its way as well. There's no question that the constant attacks on every little thing doesn't persuade independent voters, which is where they have to be, doesn't persuade true conservatives that aren't happy with the GOP anyway. I mean, and I don't see, it's going to take another shock to them to change the system. You know, the Democrats are going to have to survive this midterm. Then maybe the GOP will reassess their tactics. But right now, I agree with you. I think the public is sick and tired of the way it's being played out.
You know, and Colin, I'll paint you an example of that. And this is just one that I picked out of many that I could have potentially talked about. But I go back to the whole McChrystal debacle there and what ended up happening. And that was a legitimate black eye for this administration when you look at everything that had gone on there. And it's one of those things where I think you could have just legitimately looked at all the things that came out in the Rolling Stone article if you wanted to go through and look at things that would be embarrassing for this administration. I happened to flip past, and I never spent a lot of time watching Hannity, but I flipped past, and at the top of his show, talking about the McChrystal episode while it was still going on, he's sneeringly talking about Obama as, I think, like the chosen one. Well, the chosen one has decided to, and just sneering his way through the thing, and I wanted to reach through the screen and punch him, because I'm thinking to myself, what about the persuadable voters? What about the people that are thinking that Obama has effed up on this kind of stuff? Do you agree with me, Colin, that Obama's got a pad of at least a few points in the polls because of ass clowns like him?
Well, it's possible. You know, I think it's one of those things that probably evens out, you know, because remember, you've got a hardcore base of a few million people who watch Fox, a few million people who listen to Rush, and they overlap mostly. You know, if they're just preaching to the choir, they're getting their folks fired up. Now, of course, the lefty, you know, the lefties in public, the bloggers and people like that, can sort of jump all over these guys, you know, jump all over the Glenn Becks, et cetera, certainly the Limbaughs, and get the troops fired up a little bit. Those two effects probably cancel out. And also, I'll give you an example of something I read about on the left that really I thought was just classless. You know, should not be done. There was a vote on appropriations to the troops, you know, in Afghanistan, or, you know, using the word Afghanistan, and it was a bipartisan split. Some Democrats voted against it, some Republicans voted for it, and it, without a bipartisan, you know, coalition, that bill would not have passed. And some Democrats took a shot at Republicans who voted against the troops for voting against this appropriations bill. And to me, that is like the lowest of the low. And we've had way too much of that kind of thing. And because, you know, you're not voting against the troops, you're voting against an appropriations bill, you're voting on a policy issue. And that's not fair. That's not how we should do things here.
Right.
And, yeah, that was somebody on my side. I'll condemn that all day long.
Well, that's interesting, and I want to ask you in a moment here about, because you were at the conference when the whole WikiLeaks thing exploded yet again here in its biggest form yet. I want to ask you about that, but first I'm going to put this to each of you guys, and I'll start with you on this, Nate. This notion that when you talk about foreign policy, Afghanistan, what I'm noticing is here, you've had this recent dust-up between Ann Coulter and Bill Kristol as far as Afghanistan, and she's throwing around some paleo words like endless war and everything like that, but by the same token, she spends her entire column defending George W. Bush and the Iraq War, and basically Bush was right to do the benign neglect of Afghanistan because it was unwinnable and everything like that. So it's weird, Nate, because the press is blowing this up like, okay, is this the paleo moment and everything? And I'd love to believe it is, and Nate, you're with me on a lot of this stuff. You'd probably like to believe it too, but there's no way. Ann Coulter's not a paleo if she's out there defending Bush and the Iraq War, and yeah, we were right to do it, and what a glorious thing it was, and, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, we might like to believe, Nate, that the Republican Party is ready for a true debate on what I would call, and maybe you might call, common sense non-interventionism, but I don't think that date is anywhere near in sight yet. You don't have any presidential candidates lining up to be for that.
No, not at all. And, I mean, the neoconservative movement hijacked this party, you know, back in 1988 with the first George Bush, and it, no question about it. And, you know, the people that are smart enough to see what has happened, they've lost that base. We're not turning out to vote anymore. That's the problem. And anybody advocating George Bush's actions as being the right ones, it clearly they label, you know, they slide right into the neoconservative label. They're not paleoconservative in any way. And, you know, the true people that believe in things like the Constitution are continuously left without any voice. You know, the commentators don't give them that voice either. Commentators are all political hacks and entertainers. They're about, you know, that 1 to 2 million people that Kyle talked about, that, you know, the people that really, it's the lowest common denominator in my mind. They're talking to the idiots. You know, once you reach some level of intelligence or awareness, I wouldn't listen to any of those idiots. I can't stand, you know, Rush or Hannity or any of those people. I just can't deal with listening to it. And I think there's a lot of people like me, that political persuasion, to do the same.
Oh, exactly. And you know what? I'm going to build on that and say, you know, we got a scoop for you here on the lounge, Colin, and that is, I'll tell you what, because I don't hear this getting talked about by anybody, but we got Tom Piatek from the American Conservative, Tacky Mag, and Chronicles Magazine. He's going to be in studio in 2 weeks, a prominent paleocon guy. But I'll tell you this, Colin, you don't hear a lot of chatter about this, but there's a lot of us paleos out there that have liked, and you're going to snicker when I say this, but have always liked Sarah Palin and have stood by her through a lot of stuff and everything. But she is sounding now like she's a dyed-in-the-wool militarist, like William Kristol has captured her brain the same way he did George W. Bush. And that's one of these under-the-radar kind of things here, as far as I'm concerned, Colin, because there's a lot of people that would have, you know, she seemed like the most agreeable, two paleo-type ideas here, but she's sounding like she's a lost cause on that, and, you know, that may be a factor before the primaries are done playing out.
Well, I'll tell you, I mean, it's funny to bring up both her and Ann Coulter at the same time, because I don't expect intellectual consistency from either of them, because what they are is celebrities. They're not. I mean, Ann Coulter is not a politician. She doesn't run for anything. Doesn't have any, work for any politicians. She's just someone who writes and gets on television. She's a celebrity. Sarah Palin is pretty much the political equivalent of a celebrity. She's going to say and do what she needs to say and do, what she thinks she needs to say and do at that moment to advance her career. I think that she's either going to be president, which I think is extremely unlikely, or she's going to be an excellent talk show host going forward.
Well, just a follow-up on that, though, because I will say, and one of the things that I was drawn to, because there's a lot of, you know, I would say probably most paleos feel that, you know, have a very strong populist kind of streak, and it's... I'll grant you, it's possible to confuse the two. But looking at her record over time when she was in Alaska and being somebody who, again, knew something about her before she was on the national stage, the way that she stood up to the corruption of big oil up there in Alaska when they needed to be stood up to and everything like that, I think it was possible to look at her and look at the populism and say, you know, this is somebody that's going to come at this from a different kind of a way. Maybe I'm naive or whatever, but I am surprised.
No, I think we just have different opinions of her character.
Okay.
I don't think she is a person of good character.
Oh, all right.
She is an opportunist.
Okay.
From what I have read about her time in Arkansas, she screwed people over at the drop of a hat, dropping a political mentor, you know, in a second if it was politically expedient. I don't believe that she has any convictions.
Okay.
That's what I'm trying to say. to me, John McCain lost all credibility as a political candidate when he put her on the ticket, because it was a blatantly self-serving and manipulative move.
Okay. All right. Well, you know, if that's your perception of her, then I see exactly, you know, where you're coming from forming the opinion. I'll start with you on the next one here, because I want to get...
Rick, I just want to back Colin up here for a minute.
Yeah,
I agree with him completely. About Sarah Palin, I'll tell you why. It's for completely different reasons.
Yeah.
Back in January, she gave $1,000 to Gene Schmidt, who, you know, you and I know a lot about her.
Yeah.
I don't even know if Colin knows she exists, but once she did that, her credibility was gone. I mean, Gene Schmidt is a complete fraud. You know, I don't need to say anything else about her. She is a fraud completely, and anybody that gives money has lost her credibility. So I think I agree with Colin completely that Palin's an opportunist. If she had intelligence whatsoever, she never would have given that money to Gene Schmidt.
I'm going to defend her on that one, in that there's 435 congressional districts in the country. And I think, again, I can blame that maybe on bad staff work or somebody getting in her ear or something like that. I mean, in her defense, I agree with you on the reprehensible nature of Gene Schmidt's political career. I do not disagree with you at all on that. You and I are pretty well educated on the subject. Having said that, you know, how much of that's her personally and how much of that's a staff guy saying, hey, yo, let's get with the incumbent? You know?
There's a defense there, I agree, but it's still hard to, you know. It's definitely a bias on my part because I know way too much about Gene Schmidt. But, you know, those are the kind of mistakes you don't want to see from your elected officials,
okay,
giving money to people that have no business in office.
Yeah.
I just got one rule, buck stops at the top.
Yeah, true. But again, though, that's the, you know, when you 435 congressional districts, it's a lot to stay on top of in terms of, you know, how big of a Nimrod is this person or that person or whatever, you know, in every nook and cranny of America. So I'm a little more sympathetic, I guess, on that point. On the WikiLeaks thing, I'll start with you, Colin, so that you can give us an opinion for me and Nate to react to here. But in terms of what you were hearing over the weekend there at that conference, I've been on record with you as saying before, and I know this is something you've taken issue with, but, you know, that to me, the natural foreign policy of, if not the Democratic Party, at least the liberal movement, is a highly pacifistic one, Daisy and the gun barrel, et cetera. My preconception is that you were surrounded by a bunch of people who probably wanted us to bug out of Afghanistan a long time ago anyways. So on something like this...
No, actually, there's a great variety of opinion there, tremendous variety of opinion.
Okay.
I have very good friends who are there who actively work for, you know, peace-related issues. and we just don't agree on that necessarily. I mean, I'm not happy we're in Afghanistan, but, you know, well, we can have that debate at a different time. Well, about the WikiLeaks specifically, isn't it fascinating? I mean, just sort of from a general kind of look at what can happen now point of view. All it takes is a few people somewhere in an institution who don't want something to remain secret, and it can become not secret. Now, in this case, what's come out, you know, we're talking 7 years of documents, most of which kind of confirms things that we already knew.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the splash was kind of made. You know, it certainly gives a lot of detail to what's really going on. You know, the kind of thing, as long as it doesn't endanger anybody's safety, then I really think we need to know.
Well, you know, quick follow-up on that. What I find to be very interesting from a historical perspective here, it's been compared, of course, to the Pentagon Papers. That's the very quick and easy surface comparison. But here's the interesting thing on that. The Nixon administration vigorously opposed the release of the Pentagon Papers. Many of the most damaging aspects of those documents referred to what happened under the Democratic administrations of Kennedy and Johnson. Much
absolutely,
of-
but Nixon was continuing, you know, a policy based on that. And well, and I actually, you know, I heard that, and I kind of heard it. But someone compared the Pentagon Papers. Pentagon Papers were a really different thing. They told a very different narrative than had been told. There, you know, the American people had been told one story about why we got into the Vietnamese War, and it turned out that the Pentagon Papers revealed that the actual decisions were made for very different reasons, and it fundamentally undercut support for the war. What we're finding out from the WikiLeaks release is pretty much stuff that tells us, I mean, we knew the Pakistani Secret Service was playing both sides. You know, we knew that civilians were getting killed, unfortunately. You know, we knew all these things. It's just they get reinforced, and you get to see kind of really how nasty it is, you know?
I'll grant
you that.
Does that
make sense?
In the immortal words of former pro wrestler Sean O'Hare, I'm not telling you anything you don't already know. That is the narrative of this story. I agree with that, but it is kind of interesting. In both cases, you have administrations, you know, objecting to the release of documents which are, at least in part, damaging to their predecessors of other parties. That's a very head-scratching parallel to me.
I can see that, but, you know, but think about it also. Presidential administrations have interests that sort of are common to all administrations, and one of them is that you want to maintain control over documents.
Yeah.
You know, there's just a natural, I think Democrats and Republicans, under Democratic and Republican administrations, you know, there's always this crazy drive to classify everything, to the point that the things that are really secret, it's hard to distinguish, you know what I mean?
Right,
so that,
right.
That overclass, you know, anyway, we can have that discussed another time, but it's just, to me, it's a return to what I said originally. You know, you begin to call into question the whole notion of secrecy, because eventually just about anything will be able to get out. You know, what happens when mid-level Iranian bureaucrats start slipping information to, you know, the Iranian, you know, Iranians, expatriates scattered around the world? You know, things that can fundamentally undermine that administration, or Chinese democracy advocates, that sort of thing. Who knows? You know, this could be, you know, just another little example of a wave of sort of citizens taking over.
That terrifies me, because I'm the pessimist that believes that totalitarians will keep a lid on their dirty laundry, whereas, you know, we're fighting at a disadvantage in an open society. I guess I'm just a pessimist. Nate, do you agree with me on such a point?
Yeah, in some ways. I mean, to me, the takeaway from all this is more than just the story. It's kind of like maybe we look back in 20 years as one of the defining points of the transparent world we live in now. I mean, 20 years ago, this breaks. If the media decides to ignore it, this doesn't break. It doesn't get anywhere. The public, there's no saturation to the public ever. But now we live in the age of blogs and Twitter, and anybody can break a story at any time, and the truth can get out at any time. You know, they look back in 20 years, and people will be like, wow, 40 years ago in 1990 or whatever, who knows what was going on? We never would have found out. But these kind of things now can't be hidden forever. And I think even, the, you know, you talk about the totalitarians in charge, all it takes is one person, you know, one person to slip up, one person to share something they shouldn't, and boom, it's everywhere. And it's just, you know, like I said, I think we'll look back years from now and say, wow, that's one of the defining points where the blogs and the Twitter and the, now the new world we live in, where information is just everywhere all the time and readily available to everybody.
Could be, could be. I guess I'm just
dive in and say, amen, brother. I'm with you.
You know, but, you know, Colin, just to, again, to play devil's advocate to the point you guys are making, I guess some of my bitter cynicism stems from, I look at last year, the fizzling out of the green revolution. What China's been able to do, bullying the external internet companies into putting their filters in there. I mean, there once was a point in time when I believed technology would surmount these obstacles, but and maybe it will eventually. Maybe we're a couple of years away from a breakthrough where even the bad guys can't totally shut things down. But particularly when you look at the lessons of Iran in the summer of 2009, Colin, I think it's hard to argue with my pessimism as of this moment.
No, I hear you. But I would also point out that we don't have very many totalitarian states left.
Yeah.
I mean, even China, the China of my youth is not the China of today. You know, China is still not a democracy, but it isn't a regimented, you know, uniform society anymore. You know, it's a market-based, it's a distorted market-based, it's very corrupt and has all kinds of horrible inefficiencies. It is, you know, a market-based economy now of sorts. God knows what it's going to take to drag China into the modern world. You know, that was a little above my pay grade.
Yeah.
The pollution is getting so bad there that it is forcing the Chinese government to begin to look to alternatives to building coal-fired power plants. Now, that's a good thing for the Chinese and a good thing for us in the long run. But I want us to be the ones building, the power, you know, the wind turbines and the solar panels. Actually, if you want to know a topic that came up a lot at the Root Station, it was the green economy. It was the BP oil spill.
Interesting.
In the sense that, because, you know, there are a lot of labor unions represented there, and labor unions want jobs, you know.
Yeah.
You can say it's for their own, you know, selfish interest and wanting to grow their membership, whatever. Regardless, they want jobs. And it makes much more sense to them, and frankly to me, to build a wind turbine in Iowa and, you know, put it up in the field there and hire a guy to maintain it every now and then. It makes a lot more sense to do that than to ship, what are we spending, $700, $800 billion a year on foreign overseas oil imports?
Yeah.
And so that was the kind of thing that I heard more than anything else, honestly. Because I would say the issues that came up with anything else were obviously just the elections, period,
mm-hmm.
and what people in that audience could do to make a difference. And then the next thing was energy. Another one that came up a lot was the need for comprehensive immigration reform of some kind.
Okay.
I think everybody agrees it's broken. It's just politically, God, you know, with it, I don't know how you come up with a compromise. But nobody's happy with the current situation.
Well,
and so those are the main things that came up. And then, honestly, anger at the – there was definitely anger at the Obama administration, but it wasn't this kind of sullen resentment. It was more actually, it was very much concentrated on the Shirley Sherrod thing. There's a lot of strong feeling about don't ask, don't tell as well.
Okay. Well, I mean, look, if those are the biggest thing liberals are pissed off about, he's in good shape, because there's more of a sense that I've seen of just an undercurrent that every accomplishment that he's had has somehow been watered down. If they're PO'd about peripheral stuff, he's in better shape than I thought for turnout and everything. Let's start to bring this full circle and wrap this around here on our discussion.
And Rick, I had one question, Adam.
Yeah.
I could just jump it in there.
Yeah, yeah.
I was just curious if part of the topic out there was that what could happen in 2012 in terms of redistricting, in terms of you know, the various races across the states where, you know, the appropriation boards are going to be determined, and how the new districts are going to be drawn. Potentially it looks like the Republicans are going to have a lot of control in that process, and could lead to, just by some simple remapping, take out 20 to 30 seats from the D's. Is that something that came up, and is that something that your community is, in fear of at this point?
You, sir, have hit one of my personal obsessions. Redistricting, the first real political act I ever did was a redistricting special session in Texas in 1993, working in the Texas legislature. So redistricting is near and dear to my heart. So I went to a couple of sessions on it. It got talked about good in peripheral sessions. both state legislative redistricting and then congressional redistricting on top of that. The one or two sort of redistricting focus panels that I went to weren't that widely attended, which is pretty normal. It's kind of a nerd topic, but it's something that was in the background of a lot of conversations. And a lot of times when people were asking what they could do to help in the fall, the thing they were being told was go back to your home state and volunteer for state legislative races, blog about them, Twitter about them, Facebook about them, everything you can do to get the word out about the state legislative races. But remember, we're only talking about the 22,000, 2,500 people who are there.
Sure.
Although you're talking about, you know, most of the A-list bloggers, you know, A-list for different bloggers. We're not talking celebrities here. But and then a ton of people who write for, you know, various publications. So.
Well, you know, and that's, you know, again, Colin, this is your first time on with Nate here tonight. I am not surprised he brought up a very excellent, salient question on that matter here. I didn't think of it myself, but yeah, redistricting is going to be huge. I am not at all shocked Nate came up with that point. Let's bring this around here. Let's wrap this on the subject of the 800-pound gorilla for the fall elections, which we really haven't talked a whole lot about yet, but the very grim economy in this country. And I will say, and going back to a previous conversation, I'm almost loathe to bring this up in all seriousness, because I'm not trying to give you the I told you so, Colin, but it was a thing where this was about a year ago. You said you thought things were really going to be turning around by this point in time. And again, this is not just me from an ideological point of view with the policies coming in. I have a fear of the structural issues facing this country. I even if my policies had been implemented a year ago, do I think things would be better? Of course. But I wouldn't have bet the farm on things turning around for the fall elections either. These are such big structural issues happening. The unwinding of debt, the massive spiraling public debt that we have right now as the private debt thing is going in the other direction. So what were the thoughts you heard out there, and what are your thoughts, and how has your perspective evolved in the last year on the economy and how it's going to affect the midterms?
Well, I'll tell you, I have started a couple of different small businesses over the years, and now you know why. Mm-hmm. Because at heart, I'm an optimist, even though I act like a cynical hack.
Okay.
I thought things would be doing better right now. Man, this is just a rough time. I mean, a year ago, I was self-employed. That was not working out, so I'm now working at a firm called New Media Strategies.
Okay.
So they're a great place to work, but, you know, my own business did not succeed. So these have been difficult times. Now, there was a lot of unhappiness, but also this sense of sort of, you know, we've done everything we could possibly try. In a lot of people's eyes, the stimulus wasn't big enough, and a lot of those stimulus projects are still working their way through. Two economists came out with a model today that said that the stimulus bill, without it, would have cost X number of million jobs. Who knows? It's a model. You know, it's an economist thing. But I think generally the economy for the proudest netroots isn't really a partisan issue. It's more of a is there anything we can do kind of issue.
Okay.
You know, and there's nothing we can really get through Congress that's going to make a bit of difference, honestly. Getting the oil, I think the oil spill to a certain extent was such a downer. I mean, both a direct effect on the, you know, part of the economy, but also it affected people's moods pretty deeply. And now that that's shut off, I think that may help a little bit. I don't know. Maybe I'm too psychological on that one.
Well,
but you know, Wall Street's okay. You know, inflation. You know, consumer spending's a little down. You know, you're like, it's just kind of hard to figure out what's going on.
Well, you know, two points there. One, I really am letting you off the ideological hook on this one. But again, the fact that I was right and you were wrong, it's just I'm more of a pessimist. I'm more of a pessimist, and you're more of an optimist. And in this case,
I think that's what it comes down to.
Yes, exactly. I mean, I'm not even giving you the, you know, rah rah for my policies. I think it just comes down to how you and I see the world, and you know, everything like that. I am a public policy pessimist, to be sure. My other point was on the oil thing there. So I'm guessing you didn't hear anybody out there openly admitting that the Sierra Club blew up the oil platform to kill offshore drilling for the next generation.
You really think that's what happened?
Nobody copped to that, huh, Colin?
No.
It was amazing how Wall Street reform passes the same day they capped the well, huh? No coincidence there either, huh?
It didn't pass until they got that Democratic vote from West Virginia.
That's true.
So,
that's
it was a coincidence, I think.
Nate.
I really do think that you know, darken people's mood appreciably.
Yeah, I'm sure it did. Nate, what are your thoughts on the economy, how it's affecting the midterms here, as somebody who's worked in, you know, political campaigns here for the midterms?
Well, I think that, you know, as Colin mentioned, I think psychology plays into it. I think part of it is that a lot of entrepreneurs around the country, you know, are likely waiting, you know, to make the next plunge into business. And we know that small business and entrepreneurs is really, you know, what the economy needs to get kickstarted again, if you follow the business cycle and know those kind of things. And I think part of the problem there is that, you know, they're hoping the Republicans take control again and have a more likely scenario of, you know, tax breaks and that yada yada. So, I think the turnout is the key, as we all know. All the polls show that, you know, the GOP is going to have substantial turnout as compared to the, you know, the liberal side, and their challenge is to motivate their voters and get them out this time. And, you know, the apathy in the middle, I think, is still there. And it's always tough to be the incumbent. And when the economy's down, it's even tougher. And, you know, clearly things aren't just going to be magically better in the next few months. So I would expect that, you know, it'll be one of the issues that probably cost the Democrats control of Congress.
For what it's worth,
okay, well, can I dive in?
No,
right,
go
there?
Go ahead.
I'll make my prediction for the fall. You know, I think that Democrats are obviously going to lose seats. I mean, there's no way that we can't, you know, not lose seats. We got just about every seat that was potentially on the line in 2008 because our turnout was so high. You know, there's generally, and you know, you take that, and then you add into that just this general tendency that the president's party loses seats in the off-year election. I mean, we're going to lose no matter what. It's a question of how many. And I don't think the Republicans are going to get as many seats as they think. I think that nothing's going to happen. You know, Democrats are turning around, starting campaigning. I mean, they're done with all the hard stuff in the House and the Senate.
Yeah.
They're ready to start campaigning now. And they're going to be out there knocking down the Republicans' enthusiasm and building up the Democrats' enthusiasm. Yeah. So I say we lose 30 seats in the House and we lose, say, 4 seats in the Senate.
Colin, two things there. One, I made the same prediction in the spring of 2009 to an Obama loyalist who thought I was just being a hater. And I said, look, you got all the low-hanging fruit in the last two election cycles.
Absolutely. The all the pros think that.
Yeah, exactly. And then on a second point, this might surprise you, but Eric Bolling from Fox Business Network tonight seemed to agree with me on this when we talked about this. From your lips to God's ears on the prediction, because you know what? I don't want those incompetent cadavers, McConnell and Boehner, as scapegoat targets there for Obama to run rings around. I want Pelosi still front and center for the next 2 years. Harry Reid or Chuck Schumer or whoever's going to be leading them for the next 2 years. Do not give Obama the easy out that the Republicans did in 1995 when they took over Congress. I from your lips to God's ears, Colin. So, there, you know, that's how I see it. And my last point for the night here with you two guys, Colin, just to show you that I'm an equal opportunity guy on giving noogies here, I want to read you a quote that I read to Tommy John earlier tonight when he was on the show. I read him this and asked for a quote. This was a scout from a game back in 1987. Quote, Tommy John against Don Sutton. If anyone can find one smooth ball from that game, he ought to send it to Cooperstown. End quote. So,
nice.
I gave that to Tommy John to react to. So I'm an equal opportunity guy, Colin, as you know.
Well, thanks, guys. Yeah, it's been great being here.
Hey, it was a lot of fun. I'm glad that Nate was able to stick around for this as well. It really added something. And, yeah, the redistricting question, I wouldn't have thought of that on my own, but it was a great one. So, fellas,
That's where the redistricting is, just where the rubber meets the road in politics. It's the real deal.
Well, you know, like you, me and Nate are political nerds. We're focused on this kind of stuff, and that's the important stuff here. Listen, you got the stuff going on at epolitics.com. We always give everybody a chance to promote effusively. So whatever you got going on there, Colin, please take it away.
Oh, I'm just out there writing as much as I can, trying to catch what's going on. You know, the midterms are starting to come up, so you can begin to see some real trends about what campaigns are doing. A lot of Facebook advertising out there, a lot of Google advertising out there, and it's interesting to see what happens. So I know there are a lot of very determined Democrats, and I assume there are a lot of very determined Republicans out there as well. So this is going to be a fun fall.
It's going to be, and certainly before the votes are getting cast here, we'll have you back, or it may fall during the early voting thing, depending on you know, how our schedules work out. But we'll definitely have you back before then, and yeah, maybe we'll try and get some you know, predictions on the record here. Maybe we'll have us a little contest or something, see who can come closest on this. Again, I pray that you're right on that, and you know, the Republicans gain enough, but you know, not enough to get over the hump here, but. We shall see. Colin, always a pleasure, buddy. ePolitics.com is a great site for analysis. That's the reason we turn to you. It's always a great segment when we have you on the show. Thank you so much, as always, my man.
Thanks, man. I'll see you next time.